Mountain State Mysteries contains adult content that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. I'm your host, Mark, and sadly, I'm solo this week. Courtney and I already recorded this episode, but the audio quality just wasn't up to our standards because we're both perfectionists. So, with her being on the road for work, we came to the decision that it needed to be a solo episode because we didn't want you guys to wait another week. So, this is Mountain State Mysteries. The case I have for you today is part two to last week's episode. This is the case of Michelle Shelley Michaels. Where we left off in part one, we told you all about Shelley and Jimmy's life leading up to his murder. On Tuesday morning, Shelley arrived to work at 6:30 a.m., shockingly early for her shift. She made sure that she was seen pinching Reggie Hours on the butt. Then she checked into the nurse's station, which she never did. She called Jimmy's cell phone around 7:30 a.m., reminding him to pack lunch for the kids because Kylie wouldn't like what was on the school lunch menu that day. Shelley also made a point to call the home phone to see if anyone would pick up. After this, she told the clerk at the pediatrics wing that she left her pager in her car and that she would be right back. The clerk thought this was really odd because Shelley never wore her pager. At 8:11 a.m., she was seen on security camera leaving the parking lot of Ruby Memorial. Shelley and Jimmy only lived a mile away from the hospital, and his staff started to get concerned when he wasn't at the office yet. Like we said in part one, he was the first to show up and the last to leave. By 8 a.m., his staff were ready to do something. In all honesty, they weren't just concerned about Jimmy, but he had an appointment to set up a sleep apnea machine for a newborn baby that was being released from the hospital. They knew it wasn't like Jimmy to miss an appointment. When they called, they were worried because they knew Jimmy always had a cell phone on him and that he would always answer. At this point, Bobby Teach was out for a delivery. The office manager called him and explained what was going on. She asked if he could stop by his house to check on him. So he did just that. He drove over to check on Jimmy. Do you ever find yourself searching for a true crime podcast focused on West Virginia? Well, I have you covered. I'm Mark Covey, the creator of Mountain State Mysteries, where every Friday, my co-host Courtney and I will tell you about one of West Virginia's coldest unsolved cases. Tune in to Mountain State Mysteries on your favorite podcast platform. Two utility workers who were on Killarney Drive noticed smoke coming out of Jimmy Michaels' home. They called 911 around 10:27 a.m. Around 10:27 a.m., the windows to the upstairs bedroom blew out. Smoke and flames started to flood out the windows. When Bobby arrived to check on Jimmy, the police and fire departments were on the scene. Bobby saw that Jimmy's car was still in the garage. He started to scream that Jimmy was in the house. He ended up being so upset that they put him in a patrol car. Around 10:35 a.m., Bobby tried to call Shelley. Even though Shelley went back to get her pager, he couldn't reach her. So Bobby called his wife Kelly to see if she could get a hold of Shelley. Finally, Kelly got a hold of Shelley. She had to call the hospital to even get a hold of her. Kelly told her that her house was on fire and that she needed to leave work to get home. So Shelley calmly told that to the clerk of the pediatric wing, that she needed to leave and what all was happening. Instead of leaving right then and there, she went to her office and called Jimmy's cell phone and left another voicemail. This time, she said that the house was on fire. When the clerk saw her leave, she said she wasn't in a rush to leave. At the Michaels home, firefighters had finally made their way back to the bedroom. They realized that there was a body, so they knew they had to put out the fire to protect the body, which was already severely burned. So they called detectives to the scene. Detective Paul Mazinot and Fire Lieutenant Ken Tennant walked into the bedroom. When firefighters told the detective that there was a body on the bed, he had trouble even seeing it. Jimmy's body was burned past recognition, but when the smoke cleared out of the room, he finally saw Jimmy's teeth. They also saw that there was a trail from the bedroom to the bed. Basically, you just didn't know that there was a fire if you were anywhere else in the house. By now, Shelley had shown up, and it said that she was acting crazy, hysterical even. Rob Angus, her ex-husband, heard about the fire and dropped everything he was doing and rushed over to the scene. He was there comforting her while detectives told her that her husband was killed. However, they did notice one thing about her. She had no tears. I mean, I know everyone handles shock differently, but this made detectives and even seasoned firefighters think that something was just off. She was taken to a neighbor's house, and she laid on the couch under a blanket. She would stay there, and family and friends came to see her and check on her. Detective Mezenot questioned Shelley's ex-husband and her new lover, Rob and Bobby Teets, who both knew Jimmy well. Both of the men were upset with what happened. They both told Detective Mezenot that Jimmy did not drink, he didn't do drugs, and that he would never commit suicide. He went on to question other people that knew Jimmy, and they all said the same thing, that Jimmy was a strong religious man, a hard worker, there was no reason to believe that he would ever do this to himself. However, one reason Detective Mezenot kept pushing was due to the way Jimmy's body was positioned on the bed. It's like he was just asleep. His body wasn't found in the position of someone who would try to escape a fire, or even one that had been burned. What was left of Jimmy shown that he was asleep on his back and that he never moved. To Detective Mezenot, this seemed impossible, but Jimmy was a trained respiratory therapist and he worked in medical supplies, so maybe Jimmy injected himself and somehow started the fire? But the arson investigators did not believe this is what happened. By 12:30 p.m., Jimmy's parents got to the scene. The police were able to stop Ruth, but they couldn't stop Danny. He had to see what happened to his son, but he ended up getting into a fight with a police officer, and he didn't make it into the house. So they decided to go see how Shelley was. They both noticed that she was just laying there, that she wasn't crying or upset. Everyone noticed the lack of emotion coming from Shelley. To everyone, it was honestly unsettling. While Detective Mezenot was questioning Jimmy's ex-wife, Stephanie, she was extremely emotional. She described her relationship with her ex as good, but she did say there had been some problems. And she did not lie about the CPS investigation after Jimmy withdrew. She insisted that Jimmy was a great father. While Detective Mezenot went to talk to Shelley, she snapped at him for talking to everyone but her first. He honestly found her to be calm and trying to control the scene. Shelley's own mother described her as very detached. The entire time Ruth was there, she was watching her daughter-in-law like a hawk. Ruth said, quote, "She just sat there. She didn't cry. She just sat there," end quote. When Carrie Whitaker, one of Jimmy's oldest friends, walked in, Shelley's first words to her was, "I love your outfit. Did you get it at BMOS?" Another friend asked Shelley if she could get her anything, and she replied with, "A new husband." Investigators found out that it would be hard to move Jimmy's body from the bed without causing it more damage. It's like he was melted into the box spring. One leg was burned to the point that it was completely gone with other body parts. A hole was in Jimmy's chest that was caused from extreme temperatures, basically causing a blowout to happen. So investigators did notice one thing about Jimmy's body. His muscles never contracted like they would if you were conscious while being burned alive. While they were taking his body to the ambulance, his father Danny begged them to stop so he could look at his son. They told Danny that he would be unrecognizable, but Danny knew when they took him to the morgue, he would never see Jimmy again. Jimmy's mother Ruth said the hardest part for her was that she never saw Jimmy after the fire, and that it just didn't feel real to her. When they got Jimmy's body to the morgue for his autopsy, most of his skin had burned away. However, there were still a few patches on his back, and not all of his organs were burned. They knew Jimmy was dead before the fire. There was no snot in his throat, his sinus cavities, or his lungs. No carbon monoxide was found either, which they knew would have been there if he was breathing when the fire started. So they tested the blood and tissue from his heart, and they sent it all for toxicology testing. They also got his dental records so they could officially identify him. While everyone was going to the neighbor's house to check on Shelley, Dan, Stephanie's husband, went to be with her to help her with all of the kids. This is when he noticed Shelley and Bobby Teets laying under a blanket together. He also saw Shelley and Kelly going over Jimmy's insurance, which to me is just insane knowing what just happened and knowing everyone is there. Back at Shelley and Jimmy's house, they found out the fire burned so hot that it would take a lot of testing, so they brought in a canine dog that was trained to sniff for accelerants. The fire burned so hot that the headboard basically became engulfed and burned through the flooring, which was honestly the only way you could tell there was a fire downstairs. There were 6 places that the dog alerted to accelerants. They were all in the bedroom. It was all around the bed where Jimmy's body was found. They saw that the bed was really the only thing that sustained the fire, so they knew for sure that the bed had been doused in accelerant. So after talking to the detective, Reggie was a friend who went to the next level. He called a friend at the hospital and asked him what kind of drugs they should look for. It was actually one of Jimmy's friends, Dr. Mike Farabee. He suggested several drugs and which one would work the fastest, but he did mention one in particular, a paralytic drug called verconium, which is given to patients before they are intubated for a respirator. And I actually had Courtney Google this to tell us what the drug was about. This is what she found out. According to drugs.com, verconium is used to relax the muscles. It works by blocking the signals between your nerves and your muscles. It's given before general anesthesia and preparing you for surgery. It helps keep your body still during surgery. It also relaxes your throat so that a breathing tube can be inserted easily. Dr. Mike Farabee also said that the drug was easily accessed at the hospital because it was not a narcotic, especially in the pediatric intensive care unit where Shelley worked at Ruby Memorial. Dr. Farabee said that it just sits out to where anyone can grab it. So he put together a list of drugs to give to Detective Mezenot. While Detective Mezenot was talking with Jeremy Miller, Jimmy's friend from church, he told Detective Mezenot about the anonymous box Jimmy received in the mail that had Shelley's sweater in it. He told him it accused her of cheating. After this interview, Detective Mezenot knew he had to go interview Bobby Teets. Do you ever find yourself searching for a true crime podcast focused on West Virginia? Well, I have you covered. I'm Mark Covey, the creator of Mountain State Mysteries, where every Friday, my co-host Courtney and I will tell you about one of West Virginia's coldest unsolved cases. Tune into Mountain State Mysteries on your favorite podcast platform. During the interview, Bobby went over the relationship between the couples and talked about how all 4 of them were really good friends. He talked about the embroidery business him and Shelley were going to start, but he never talked about the affair they were having. He did say that he wished the fire was an accident and that he hoped Jimmy died peacefully. He said, quote, "It bothers me every day just thinking about it. I would be happier to know that he didn't suffer. I would be able to sleep a lot better," end quote. I'm not sure if Bobby knew that him or Shelley could be suspects in Jimmy's death, but he had an alibi, so the police weren't looking at him too hard. But one thing they did want to find out was his affair with Shelley. Detective Mezenot wanted proof about the Chicago trip Shelley and Bobby took. So after his interview with Bobby, he called the hotel to confirm there had been only 1 room booked, and he arranged to have surveillance cameras checked immediately. So now Detective Mezenot sat down with Bob Angus, who also told him to test for drugs. Ironically, Bob also had a connection at Ruby Memorial. His sister Shannon Ruby, who was one of Shelley's nursing supervisors, she told Rob to tell the investigators that they needed to look for 1 drug, verconium. The fact that 2 different men, who had no idea the other said this, both told the investigator to look for 1 specific drug, basically told the investigators that they really needed to look for it. Reggie Bonnell decided to have his own conversation with Shelley. He played along, acting sympathetic, gently questioning her on what she really thought happened to Jimmy. She told him that she was afraid that she left an iron-on in the bedroom, and that she felt really guilty about it. Reggie told her that an iron would not have caused that type of fire, but Shelley, being Shelley, insisted on that the fire was caused by that. So what Reggie did after his talk with Shelley, he immediately called Detective Mezzanot and told him everything. After the fire, Shelley was staying with Jimmy's parents in Cumberland, Maryland. A friend called her and offered to collect Shelley's mail and bring it to her. Shelley casually said to just look for an envelope from Morgantown Bank and Trust. It would have been a bank card from the memorial fund. That was the only mail she wanted to see. That Saturday, Jimmy's obituary appeared in the newspaper, the same day of the visitation and funeral. The family arrived first. Shelley insisted on seeing Jimmy's body. However, the funeral director refused. He said that she should not see him in this condition. Jimmy's father actually told Shelley that he saw him and that she did not want to see him. Shelley was outraged and started to cause the scene. She said she didn't care the state of his body. She wanted to see it. Carrie Whitaker was at the visitation. She not only watched Shelley herself, but many of the people her and Jimmy grew up with walked up to her and asked her what in the world was wrong with Shelley. Carrie later gave her own opinion to detectives, saying Shelley just seemed cold. Drew, Jimmy's son, was inconsolable at his father's visitation. He sat on top of the closed casket, talking to his father. Stephanie went to try to talk to her son. Shelley threw another fit and said she wanted to be alone with her husband and that everyone needed to get out. Shelley would even complain after the funeral about Drew. After the visitation, Shelley would ask Jimmy's parents if Bobby and Kelly Teach could spend the night at their home. She was spending the night again and just wanted as much comfort as possible. They agreed to let them stay. And of course, Jimmy's family had their own suspicions about Shelley. For now, they just wanted to keep peace with Shelley. After everyone went to bed, Denny was still up. He couldn't sleep, so he decided to leave the house for a bit. When Danny came back, he didn't want to use the front door in case he would wake anyone up. So he used the basement door, and that's when he caught Shelley and Bobby hugging, and Bobby was kissing Shelley on the cheek. When Shelley saw him, she pushed Bobby away. She would end up pretending that Denny didn't see them together. At the funeral the next day, Drew was sobbing hysterically. Stephanie was crying as well. And when she looked over at Shelley, she saw that there was no emotion whatsoever. The funeral was very heartbreaking, and no one could believe that Shelley was showing no emotion. They said that she just seemed so damn cold.
Do you ever find yourself searching for a true crime podcast focused on West Virginia? Well, I have you covered. I'm Mark Covey, the creator of Mountain State Mysteries, where every Friday, my co-host Courtney and I will tell you about one of West Virginia's coldest unsolved cases. Tune in to Mountain State Mysteries on your favorite podcast platform.
The next Monday, Ruby Memorial granted Shelley a 6-month leave of absence. What she did next was head straight to the insurance agent. First thing that morning, Shelley was there to get the instructions on how to fill out the paperwork to file a claim so she could collect the life insurance policy. She had to go to Jimmy's office because he owned 55% of the company and she needed his partners to buy him out. Monday afternoon, Shelley would hesitantly agree to a memorial service in Morgantown. She tried to fight going and tried to get out of it, but Jimmy's family insisted that his local friends and co-workers wanted to say goodbye. She finally agreed, but she made them move it to the following day, making it hard to publicize so everyone would know. Shelley, being Shelley, was adamant that they just need to get it over with. The morning of the memorial service, Shelley met with the pastor, Reverend Goodwin, and of course she brought Bobby Teets with her. The two were holding hands in the office the entire time, as Reverend Goodwin went over the plans for the evening. Reverend Goodwin just thought that Bobby could have been family, but kept growing more and more uncomfortable with how close the two were. He said, quote, "I honestly felt like they behaved more like lovers than friends," end quote. He also talked about how Shelley had no emotion about the entire situation. He said that she had no interest in giving input on the planning and told the Reverend to just take care of it, which, like anyone else, found to be very odd. Jimmy's parents arrived early that evening for the memorial service. They were meeting with Detective Mezenot. Denny basically told him that he thought Shelley killed Jimmy. He even said that he thought she drugged his son. Denny definitely did not know the tips that everyone was giving Detective Mezenot. It was just Denny's intuition. Detective Mezenot came to the service so he could observe her behavior. He said that he saw Shelley was not just attached, but she was overly irritated during the entire service. The next day, Detective Mezenot had interviews set up with both Shelley and Bobby. He set them up back to back, with Bobby going in first. Shelley would just be sitting in the waiting room wondering what Bobby was saying. Now, police had the videos from the Chicago hotel, as well as the footage of Shelley leaving the hospital the day of the murder. It wasn't long into Bobby's interview until he broke. He immediately confessed to the affair he was having with Shelley. He said that he was not in love with Shelley and wanted to stay with his wife. He said that him and Shelley had sex numerous times, and he also talked about the trip to Chicago. He wanted the affair to stay a secret, but detectives told him it couldn't. Bobby would be required to testify at the trial, and that it would just be smart to break the news to Kelly now. When Shelley got into the room, they immediately told her Bobby's confessions. She denied the affair and started to detail their trip to Chicago, saying that the one room was just to save some money, saying it was a suite and that Bobby slept on the couch. Detective Mezenot accused her of lying, and Shelley would not admit to anything. So he brought up the fire. He told her that Jimmy's death and the fire were both suspicious, and she showed no emotion at all. Then he said the fire was caused by arson, and she replied, quote, "You're joking," end quote. He told her about the blood and tissue samples that had been sent off. He told her, quote, "We pretty much have an idea from the autopsy on how he died," end quote. She said, "Okay, can you tell me?" Detective Mezenot was playing hardball with Shelley, basically acting like Shelley's friend during the entire interview. Shelley was even calling Detective Mezenot by his first name, which was Paul. He begged and begged her to come clean, just to unburden herself, to help herself by telling the truth. She finally said that she understood how her and Bobby's relationship could be misunderstood, that she insisted that they were just friends and nothing more. Detective Mezenot started to ask about the day of the fire. He asked Shelley to walk him through everything that happened. She told him the same story as before, when she arrived to work, making her rounds, the trip to the car for the pager. None of her story changed. Detective Mezenot started to ask about the fire, then said, quote, "I have a feeling you know Jimmy didn't suffer," end quote. Shelley said she had no idea what he was talking about. This went on for about 2 hours, and Shelley did not break down and confess. After the interview, Shelley called Bobby, and she asked him what he said. Bobby lied to her and said that he hadn't told police anything. But after their conversation, he never really spoke to her again. He went home and confessed everything to his wife, Kelly. He was now fully willing to cooperate and wanted to save his marriage. Kelly was actually shocked about his confession. After this, Bobby wanted to take a polygraph exam. He knew that he was a suspect, and he really wanted to clear his name. He passed. Next, it was Shelley's turn to take a polygraph. Sergeant Merrill, a polygraph examiner with more than 20 years of experience, he watched Shelley's interview with Detective Mezenot through two-way glass. He watched her try to control and manipulate the interview. When Sergeant Merrill got into the room, he used the same method, just pretending to be her friend. He even called her honey, saying he understood she was upset. This was just the interview before she was hooked up to the polygraph machine. Detective Merrill wanted to get Shelley shaken up before he started the exam. The first time he caught her off guard is when he told her that there was camera footage of her leaving the hospital. She actually appeared shocked, but quickly regrouped. Then she told him that she remembered that she had decided to move her Ford Expedition into the parking garage because it was raining. So Sergeant Merrill pointed out that her car was gone for about 17 minutes. Then it showed her walking back inside, just not from the parking garage. She was like, Yeah, I drove around the garage for a while, unable to find a spot before returning to the parking lot. He then asked her if she by chance went to her house. She of course said no. She was certain that she didn't. He asked if anyone had seen her at the house that day and she said no. Shelley said she did not leave the hospital. Then he tried to catch her off guard when he asked her why Bobby Teach said they had been having an affair. She denied the affair by saying she had no idea why he would say something like that. After the first set of questions, he explained how the polygraph worked. He told her that the two tubes go around her thyroid and abdominal area to monitor her breathing and a cardio cuff on her arm to watch her blood pressure. Then he showed her a set of numbers on a piece of paper and told her to circle one and then to put it in her pocket. He told her he wanted her to lie about that number, to tell him a completely different number. As he would read them off, she was to say no to each one. After she was done, he told her that she picked number 5. Now, Shelley was scared. She honestly didn't want anything to do with the polygraph at this point. He picked her number. He knew the number she lied about, so she asked to stop the test. So while he was unhooking her, she confessed to the affair. Shelley said, quote, "Listen, I'm not taking your polygraph, but I'll be honest with you. I did have the affair," end quote. I think Shelley just thought she would walk into the room, make the interview go the way she wanted, and pass it with flying colors. When Sergeant Murrell picked up on the very first lie, it honestly had nothing to even do with Jimmy. She was shaken and bolted. She left the room and went back to the room with Detective Mezenot. A few minutes later, Sergeant Murrell joined the two. The tone of the room switched and became accusatory. The detectives told her that they had an eyewitness that saw her in the driveway at 8:20 a.m. the morning of the fire. Shelley didn't even flinch. She kept saying that she never left the hospital grounds. The thing is, Shelley knew detectives weren't lying. So the neighbor Shelley was told about was actually a respiratory therapist at Ruby Memorial. Shauna Loop had been coming home from working the night shift. Ironically, he was also a volunteer firefighter. It was raining when he got home, and he lived down the street from Shelley. When he got out of his car, he smelled smoke, but it wasn't like normal chimney smoke. He knew that it was the smell of a house fire. So he walked around his house, and he knew it wasn't his. He stood in the driveway and looked around at the neighborhood. He couldn't see anything. The reason he couldn't see anything is because the house wasn't on fire. It was just the bed Jimmy was in. So he decided to go inside and shower. Then he came back out and decided to drive to the firehouse. He could still smell the smoke. He just had no idea where it was coming from. Around 8:20 a.m., he passed Shelley at the stop sign at the top of the hill on their road. He knew her as a neighbor and a co-worker, so he waved, and Shelley ignored him. He honestly wasn't surprised by this. In the hospital, she was known for her moods, so he didn't think anything of it, and he continued to drive to the fire station. He confirmed that nothing was called in about the fire on his street. Then he fell asleep in his bunk. He was woke up around lunch by another firefighter who told him about the fire on Killarney Drive, just a couple houses down from his. So he called his friend Reggie Hours, who told him that Jimmy hadn't made it to work. Sean told him that it was weird because he smelled smoke earlier, and that he saw Shelley, but there wasn't anything on fire at the time. Reggie didn't say anything else and hung up. A few minutes later, Detective Mezenot called Sean.
Do you ever find yourself searching for a true crime podcast focused on West Virginia? Well, I have you covered. I'm Mark Covey, the creator of Mountain State Mysteries, where every Friday, my co-host Courtney and I will tell you about one of West Virginia's coldest unsolved cases. Tune in to Mountain State Mysteries on your favorite podcast platform.
Reggie actually called Detective Mezenot with another tip. Shelley definitely wouldn't have known that the tip was Sean, so all she did was stare back at the cops, showing no emotion whatsoever. Sergeant Murrell said all he got was a cold stare while Detective Mezenot tried explaining how he would word it to the prosecutor, that there was a fire and Shelley had 17 minutes that were not accounted for, and that they knew she was lying because they had a witness who saw her. But Shelley being Shelley just stuck to her story, and she didn't budge. Sergeant Murrell asked Shelley how long her drive was to work. She said 10 minutes. He said, "Really?" Then she changed the time, saying it was probably more like 5 minutes. Detective Mezenot spoke up and told Shelley that he tested the drive himself. He had made it from the hospital to Shelley's home in 4 minutes. He said he waited in the driveway maybe 3 or 4 minutes. Plenty of time to run in the house, douse the bed in accelerant, strike a match, then leave. And went back to the hospital, and he actually beat the 17-minute time frame. Detective Mezenot and Sergeant Murrell spent the next few minutes playing good cop and bad cop with Shelley. Detective Mezenot was playing the good cop, which made sense because Shelley was still calling him Paul. Sergeant Murrell told her that she should trust Detective Mezenot because he was the only one on her side, and that there was no way they could explain those 17 minutes to a jury without her cooperation. After almost 2.5 hours of interrogation, Shelley did admit that she did leave the hospital grounds that day, but she claimed that she just had to pick something up for her son and take it to his school. So I think she realized quickly how bad this lie was, because both detectives asked her what she went to the house for. She quickly said that she never went in the house, that she actually decided that she didn't need it, so they asked her what she needed. She ended up finally saying that it was the paperwork that she needed to fax to the importer financing. Then they asked her why she didn't go inside the house and get it. She said that all of a sudden she realized that she had it with her, so she turned back around and went to work. The most important thing of this is the fact that they got Shelley to admit that she did leave work and went to the house that morning, right at the time her co-worker and witness started to smell smoke. The detectives had her now. They kept asking her why she lied. And she said that she didn't want her boss to find out that she left the hospital, and that she was scared she was going to get in trouble again. Sergeant Murrell asked her if she wasn't more scared of getting arrested. Then he informed her that they knew the fire was no accident, and that they knew Jimmy was dead before it even started. They knew that she was lying, that she was the number one suspect. And then he left the room. After 6 hours, Shelley left the station. She was trying to play it cool, like she was innocent, with Detective Mezenot, who continued to play good cop with her. She insisted that she only left out the affair with Bobby out of embarrassment. She also said she left out going to the house that morning because she felt guilty for not going inside. She said if she had only gone inside, she could have saved her husband. Later, Detective Mezenot and Sergeant Murrell both agreed that Shelley was one of the most arrogant, cold, and calculated people they have ever interviewed in 20 years. Shelley went to her parents' house that evening and told her mother that the police were just trying to scare her. Her mother, Kathy Goots, was actually scared. She said, "We need to get you an attorney," and she got on the phone. The next morning, Detective Mezenot got a call from a prominent defense attorney from Clarksburg named Tom Dreyer. Tom told Detective Mezenot that he was now representing Shelley, and she would no longer be answering his questions. Bobby Teach would go in for a post-polygraph interview. Even though he did pass, there were still some red flags. The investigators believed him when he said he felt guilty because of the affair, and he feared Shelley killed Jimmy so her and Bobby could be together after his death. Around Christmas time, Bobby took another polygraph exam. This, with the information on his movements that morning, helped police clear him as a suspect. Shelley was, of course, going on with her life, as if she wasn't the main suspect in the murder of her own husband. She would go by the house and pick some things up. On December 13th, she met with the insurance company again, who told her that the payout was not imminent because the fire was considered suspicious. So Shelley agreed to be questioned on tape. Now, she mentioned the iron theory. She told investigators that she ironed a shirt for that morning, and sometime before, she had noticed that the iron was an automatic switch off if none of the features were working. She thought that she possibly just left it on and it fell over. This isn't the first time Shelley tried to use this theory. She told it to Reggie Hours, and he thought it was crazy, but that was her story for now.
She said the only phone call she could think of was to Carrie Whitaker, Jimmy's closest friend, so Detective Mezenat wanted a phone interview. Carrie said that she spoke to Jimmy once a week on the phone, and they would never miss a call. She provided Detective Mezenat with as much information as she could. She even told him about Shelley trying to force him to have another child. She also gave him the clinical analysis of Shelley's behavior at Jimmy's funeral. After this, Tom Dreyer, Shelley's attorney, gave interviews to TV shows and the author John Glatt, who wrote the book Playing with Fire. And in all honesty, his book was one of the many resources we used for this episode. You can either buy it or listen to it on Audible like I did. Tom Dreyer said, when he first met Shelley at his office, he left the room for a moment and he left his Coke on the table. When he came back into his office, he'd be damned before he picked up that can of Coke again, after it sat there unattended with Shelley. He told John Glatt, quote, "The first thing that catches your attention are her Charles Manson eyes. She's the only woman I've met in my life with absolutely black hole eyes. Look right into her eyes and tell me it doesn't send a shiver down your spine," end quote. On December 23rd, the Dominion Post ran the story about officials being back on the scene, which prompted the claim that Shelley had no right to be in her own house. That Christmas, Jimmy's parents had to keep up the front and see her. Drew, Jimmy's son, actually refused to even be around her. Ruth and Steve, Jimmy's brother, went to dinner with Shelley. Shelley was mad that Drew and Denny wasn't there. Steve said that she was bubbly, like you never thought she lost her husband less than a month ago. On January 9th, Shelley turned in a 34-page handwritten summary of everything she lost in the fire to the insurance company. Here are a few things that she claimed. $40 for her framed wedding vows, $72 for a basket of nail polish. She listed the number of socks Jimmy kept in their drawer. The second week of February 2006, Jimmy's talk screen came back, and he tested positive for the drug Verconium. Related to the drug Verconium, that was the drug that everyone told them to look for. The blood from Jimmy's heart contained a high level of the paralytic drug, so they sent off the liver tissue for further testing just to be sure. On March 4th, the second toxicology report came back, and Jimmy's death certificate was changed by the chief medical examiner. Jimmy's cause of death was now listed as homicide by unintentionally lethal dose of Verconium by another person. And of course, I had Courtney Google this drug too, and this is what she told me. According to drugs.com, Verconium is given prior to general anesthesia while preparing you for surgery. Verconium helps to relax your muscles and keep your body still during surgery. Verconium also relaxes the throat, allowing a breathing tube to be placed for those who need a mechanical ventilator. A few days after the death certificate was changed, Denny Michael actually got a copy of it in his mailbox. They sent it to him by mistake. The police were actually relieved that Denny got it instead of Shelley. Denny said they better go arrest her, or he was going to go down there and find out why. Finally, the criminal complaint was written up for Michelle Shelley Michaels. The same afternoon, a magistrate signed an arrest warrant, and Shelley was picked up. Shelley went before the Morgantown Magistrate Court and was granted a $100,000 bond for the arson charge. Shelley would be transferred to jail before she could even be considered for bond on the murder charge. That charge was up to the circuit court judge. The next morning, the headline for the Dominion Post was "Wife Charged with Murder. Shelley Michael Also Accused of Arson in Fatal Suncrest Fire." The following morning, Shelley was granted a $350,000 bond by the circuit court judge. 6 days after her arrest, Shelley's parents posted the full $450,000 bond, and Shelley walked out of jail. She was supposed to stay confined to her home and be electronically monitored. However, it wasn't long until the citizens of Morgantown started to see Shelley. She found every single way possible to get around her restrictions. She was allowed to go to the doctor, work, and the grocery store, but that was it. Shelley was also seen around the mall, and even talked to the officer who checked her monitor about moving the monitor to her thigh just so it wouldn't show when she wore a dress. No one would hire Shelley after this, so she had to take a job in Clarksburg. She continually got caught where she shouldn't be, and she was finally put in front of the judge. The judge said that she violated regulations. It wasn't serious enough to revoke her bond. The hit show 48 Hours set up camp in town, getting interviews with anyone they could. Soon after the affair with Bobby Teets hit the headlines, now Shelley was hated by the public. The citizens of Morgantown started to call the sightings of Shelley the Shelley sightings because of how often they happened.
Do you ever find yourself searching for a true crime podcast focused on West Virginia? Well, I have you covered. I'm Mark Covey, the creator of Mountain State Mysteries, where every Friday, my co-host Courtney and I will tell you about one of West Virginia's coldest unsolved cases. Tune in to Mountain State Mysteries on your favorite podcast platform. Tom Dreyer, her attorney, said that she tried to control every single aspect of her defense, writing up her own briefs, character analysis of Jimmy's friends and family. She even wrote the closing statement that she wanted Tom to use. The only thing that Tom and Shelley agreed on was that she would have to testify. Tom said, quote, "It's a right she has, but 12 people in the jury don't give a shit. Their immediate reaction is, son of a bitch, this person's got something to hide," end quote. Shelley would spend weeks rehearsing at Q&A sessions with Tom and his associates. They won a very important motion of getting the trial moved to Charleston, West Virginia due to the publicity. The Morgantown investigators had called the state police, FBI, and the AFT to figure out how the fire was started. The AFT would compile 7 different models for their trial, all of which showed the same exact thing. The problem no one could understand was how the fire could smolder for hours after Shelley was seen at 8:20 a.m., before the worker saw the smoke at 10:30 a.m. and called it in. The AFT models found out that the fire needed oxygen. Shelley did make a mistake. She had closed the bedroom door. With the door and the windows being closed, there wasn't much oxygen to feed the flames. But when the headboard finally fell through the bottom of the floor, that left enough oxygen in for the room to become engulfed and finally blow out the windows. Police and firefighters had been to the scene and quickly put it out. The AFT were able to prove that the bed Jimmy was on could have smoldered for over 2 hours until it got enough oxygen to engulf into a full-on fire. The last Shelley sighting was in June of 2007. Shelley was seen getting her nails done. The state put on a strong case. The evidence was circumstantial. The sighting of Shelley at 8:20 that morning from the hospital cameras. The drug used to kill Jimmy was at her disposal. Her affair with Bobby Teets. All of this made her look bad, but it didn't prove that she killed her husband. There really wasn't any physical evidence to tie her to the crime scene. Despite the syringe being found, which had no fingerprints on it. Knowing Shelley, being a nurse, she wore gloves while she injected Jimmy. One thing that they did find at the crime scene was the syringe cap under the bed, which is actually normal. I know you're probably like, Mark, how is that normal? Well, from our research, nurses usually never recap a syringe. So it was just normal for Shelley to leave it on the floor under the bed, which I'm sure she never thought of again, thinking that the house would just burn down. In all honesty, prosecution wasn't 100% sure if they had her or not. During our research, we actually found the journal from the jury, and we were shocked. Not everyone was fully convinced that Shelley killed Jimmy. One juror wrote about how slowly her story unraveled, and they could not believe the lack of emotion coming from Shelley, especially when photos were shown. They said that they could hear Jimmy's family sobbing in the courtroom, and that they just saw Shelley sitting there with no emotion on her face. They said that she was busy writing notes to her attorney, but she took the stand. The juror said, at that point, they really tried to convince them that the huge mountain of evidence they had on her was wrong, and that she couldn't have done it. However, no amount of pre-trial training with Tom Dreyer could stop the real Shelley from showing up on the stand. She doubled down on 3 ridiculous scenarios of the crime itself, even saying that Jimmy committed suicide.
When Shelley stepped down from the stand, they were horrified, but no longer conflicted. Michelle Shelley Michael was convicted of first-degree murder and arson. In the jury journal, it did say they did stay out for a few days because initially they were split. But going back over all of the testimony, there was no doubt that Shelley killed Jimmy. At her sentencing, Shelley was allowed to make her statement, and she went on about self-pity and told the jury that a life sentence for her was also one for her children. Jimmy's family was also able to make a statement. They were powerful, but what was said to be the most devastating statement was a letter from Jimmy's daughter, Jacy. Shelley Gutz has a cold-blooded heart and an evil mind. I hope you give her the maximum by law, end quote. The judge agreed with this and also sentenced her to 20 years for arson to be served consecutively, meaning that she might get paroled after 15 years for the murder. She would still have to serve 20 years for the arson though. After the sentencing, Shelley stood up to get a final word. Quote, I mean no disrespect. I am not cold. I am not calculated. And I did not kill my husband. End quote. The judge replied, You're guilty, and innocence is not the issue. It has already been decided. There was a website called Justice for Shelley. We tried to access it through a system, and sadly we couldn't. However, there is still a Facebook page ran by Kylie. There are some emotional posts on there, but there's not much on it. In 2023, Shelley made headlines again. She had been serving her life sentence at the Lincoln Correctional Center, Monongahela County Circuit Court, in front of more than 24 people, being represented by Tom Brzezinski. He argued that Shelley's then-attorney Tom Dreyer insufficiently constitutionally defended her and provided an effective counsel. Shelley's defense had until March to file all of the necessary paperwork in attempt to get her a new trial. From there, the state of West Virginia will have until August of this year to answer. If it is found out that he did not constitutionally represent Shelley, she will receive another trial, and Tom Dreyer will be called to testify. If this happens, we will be the first to update you on the case of Michelle Shelley Michaels. This is the part of the podcast where Courtney and I usually share our final thoughts. And typically, if it's a solo episode, I don't do it. But I wanted to tell you guys that Courtney actually sent me this case during season one, and that this case has been one of the longest ones we covered. In the middle of writing the script for part one, I sent a text to Courtney and was like, yo, this needs to be a two-parter. I do believe that Shelley is guilty, and I believe that she was used to getting everything that she wanted. I believe that she is still doing that in prison today. If she does go back to trial in August, I will be glued to my phone and everything else just so we can update you guys on this case. We will be back next week with a brand new episode. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, rate, and download us on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find good West Virginia true crime podcasts. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook, all at Mountain State Mysteries. Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com. For the show notes, check out our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com. Thank you.